This episode of Exploring AI in Oncology from Oncology Data Advisor is sponsored by Foundation LMS. Foundation LMS is a state-of-the-art learning management system that can help you deliver engaging online activities that adhere to the latest accreditation standards. Foundation LMS is purpose-built for the continuing education industry, empowering you to deliver world-class education while ensuring compliance with accrediting bodies such as the ACCME, ANCC, and ACPE. Captivate your learners with highly personalized and engaging educational activities. Leverage our intuitive course authoring tools to build interactive content. Stay in control of your learners' progress with our robust tracking and reporting features. Customize certificates with your own branding, automate outcomes data reporting, and enjoy exceptional customer support 24/7. Visit foundationlms.com to learn more and try Foundation LMS for 30 days risk-free. Welcome to Oncology Data Advisor, where we explore the latest advances in cancer research and patient care. Thanks for listening to this episode. Be sure to visit oncdata.com for more content, including expert perspectives from leading oncology thought leaders, FDA approvals, patient advocacy, and much more. And don't forget to subscribe to Oncology Data Advisor on social media to stay up to date on the latest videos, podcasts, and more.
Welcome to our latest episode of Oncology Data Advisor in our AI technology series. My name is Lucas. I'm a theater resident at NYU. I'll be starting oncology fellowship at UChicago. I went to medical school at UT Southwestern, where I had the sort of pleasure of meeting today's guest, Dr. Shalin Baig, who's been the director of GI Medical Oncology and has been at UT Southwestern for over a decade and has since sort of been leading efforts in the decentralized clinical trial space. Before we get started with today's episode, Dr. Baig, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you. I had a pleasure to work with Vikas for many years now. I work at the intersection of health information technology and clinical research, trying to see how we can use the technology tools that are available to improve evidence generation and how we perform clinical trials. So focusing on technology-enabled clinical trial delivery, both in the cancer treatment space as well as in the early diagnostic space, and super excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much. I just want to get started sort of by asking, you know, like a lot of our audience, they're oncologists in the prior practice setting, the community setting, in the academic setting. What's it been like for you to transition to the industry side and sort of what are your day-to-day responsibilities kind of look like on that end?
Yeah, I view my role as not being the traditional industry job. I think when folks refer to industry, they think of pharma positions, either with biotech or medium-sized biotech or large pharma, where you're actually working for the sponsor. The experience that I've had has been around working with sponsors as a clinical trial investigator, as a clinical trial site to bring clinical trials to our patients. But it has been a very different experience in performing and leading clinical trials in an academic setting versus developing it in a more private setting where there's a lot more emphasis on quality, on speed, on delivery, and again with the focus that I've had on ways to reduce the burden for trial participation, with less focus, I would say, on traditional academic metrics such as publications and grants. Now, it's interesting that they both can happen in different environments, but I think the focus and how much energy you dedicate to those different aspects is different depending on what kind of position someone's holding.
Got it. Okay, thanks for explaining that sort of distinction. So I saw that you had a recent viewpoint published at JAMA Oncology that talked about innovative clinical trials. Just for our audience, can you just explain maybe some of the different kind of trial design methods that you talked about in the paper?
Yeah, so when we think about ways to improve clinical trial access, like we've seen in precision oncology specifically, that our protocol development process has really changed in the last 10 or 15 years. The leaders in the space recognized that we can't just keep opening individual protocols for every disease indication every time. And we saw the development of basket studies, platform trials, umbrella trials that are looking to test multiple hypotheses in the same protocol. And that really helps streamline clinical trial oversight and activation and organization. And we've seen FDA approvals stem from a lot of those activities. And a lot of those have led to early signals of trials that spun off into other registrational studies. But they didn't solve a problem that I feel is the most important problem plaguing precision oncology clinical trials and oncology clinical trials in general, and that's access to clinical trials. Because most of the sites that were involved in those clinical trials were larger centers or centers that had established safety profile, established clinical trial programs. And most of the patients with cancer, most of the people with cancer are not seen at those centers. So they were able to innovate and address a big chunk of administrative burden for clinical trials, but not the access issue. And when you see where we are right now, due to changes that started before the COVID-19 pandemic, during the COVID-19 pandemic, and since the COVID-19 pandemic, we're seeing that it is very possible for us to incorporate decentralized clinical trial methods to bring clinical trial procedures where patients already are, whether that means letting someone continue seeing their primary oncologist wherever they may be and allow them to be enrolled onto a clinical trial through a central process that allows all the clinical research, clinical trial activities to take place in a decentralized manner, including the investigator oversight, nursing support, drug shipment to the patient, using local imaging for evaluating the patients. And the oncology space, and this has been happening outside of oncology for a long time, and the oncology space was lagging because, rightfully, people were worried that people with cancer are sicker and cancer drugs are more toxic than your traditional drug for other indications. But what we're seeing is that for a lot of clinical trials, particularly precision oncology clinical trials, that's not true. The patients are healthier and the drugs don't have the same side effect profile that cancer therapeutics was notorious for in the 90s. So in this paper, we presented our vision on how decentralized clinical trial methods can be used to modernize how we are performing precision oncology trials and help address the issue of lack of access to clinical trials. Because we can harmonize the protocols as much as we want, we can reduce the inclusion criteria or make them more inclusive as much as we can, but if the trials aren't available where the people are already present, then access is very limited. And it's very naive for us to think that someone, that anybody who's eligible for a clinical trial has the resources, the capability, the strength, the infrastructure to go to clinical trial centers to participate in clinical studies. And we kind of break down what decentralized methods could really look like in terms of identifying people for precision medicine, precision oncology clinical trials, for shipping medications, using local imaging, and monitoring folks so that we can ensure that patient safety is maintained, all while the patient can continue maintaining their relationship with their primary oncologist and not have to move, which is a win-win.
I definitely agree it's so important to address the lack of access. Only 6% of patients in this country who are eligible for oncology clinical trials end up in a trial. And if you live even 60, 70 minutes outside of a cancer center, it's probably hard to access those trials that you mentioned. Talk a little bit about maybe a pain point that you see with decentralized trials when it comes to maybe patient selection or maybe the kinds of treatments you use and sort of how that's being solved.
I think I talked a little bit about it when we were talking about the previous topic. And the challenge is that not every oncology clinical trial can incorporate decentralized methods. So there are always going to be medications that have a side effect profile that does not lend itself well to decentralized methods, or there's a patient population that will not lend itself for decentralized methods, inpatient centers being an example, early studies where we don't have the side effect profile, the toxicity profile of the agent is unknown. Like that's another major example. And it's important that we don't spend energy in trying to apply these to the wrong trials. and focus on the studies where we are ready to try and make that happen. And it comes down to demonstrating that we can ensure participant safety, so they're not at any increased risk for by participating in a trial that's supported with decentralized methods, and by ensuring that we can collect the relevant endpoints in a compliant manner. And for most oncology studies, we are able to prove both of those points. During the COVID-19 pandemic, there were many studies that came out that evaluated ER visits, quality of life, toxicity for people who were just managed using teleoncology versus those that were using brick and mortar services, and there was no difference. In some instances, it may actually have been better. That's not to say that that's never required, but if I'm sitting in Dallas and I enroll someb 2.5 hours away in West Texas, my oversight for them while they're not under my direct purview is very similar to the process that we use when we incorporate decentralized methods to manage someone on a clinical trial. And then when it comes to the endpoints, most of the oncology trial endpoints are survival, progression-based endpoints, quality of life surveys or performance status endpoints, or blood sample collection that we can very, very simply perform in a decentralized manner using home-based nursing, using telemedicine approaches, using local labs, using local imaging facilities. And that's why I believe this is going to be a large part of how clinical trials are going to be developed moving forward, both due to pressure from our sponsors, but also from the desire of cancer programs and cancer centers to better serve their catchment areas and the people who are in their neighbor, in their areas, and to broaden their radius of influence for people who can enroll on clinical trials. And the FDA has released draft guidance. We're waiting for what the final guidance will look like, but they've delivered draft guidance, which essentially speaks to their support for utilizing these methods in situations where the investigators feel that it's allowable. And I don't think that we should ever come up with a list of studies that can or cannot use. It's rather cannot use decentralized methods. Rather, it's a mindset for us to think about what are the procedures where we don't require people to come in. You know, it could be the 15-hour PK. It could be a survey. It could be e-consent or pre-screening activities using local facilities for scans, like I mentioned.
Got it. No, thanks for sharing all that. Shifting gears a little bit, you know, everyone talks about how AI is affecting this or that. I don't know if there's a clinical trial of GPT that's out yet, but just talk a little bit about how machine learning AI might impact some of the work being done to facilitate decentralized trials.
One of the areas that's being, we're already seeing a lot of products being developed is in patient identification and recruitment, and how you can use natural language processing methods to find people who are eligible for clinical trials. They still have a long way to go in many instances. For example, one of the criteria that is hard to develop before sort of the AI awareness came about is line of therapy. But with natural language processing method, that's something which can be inferred for a lot of patients and improve our ability to find patients. We're still plagued by lack of interoperability between systems. So it's hard to screen people who don't belong to the health system where the trial is available. We are seeing really novel efforts using health information exchanges to get some of that data in a searchable format. So there is a lot of development in patient identification and recruitment, which I'm really excited. And I think we're going to start seeing really good impact, at centers in the next, even this year, in terms of making it more feasible to find the right patient at the right time of their journey for the trials. And the other aspects in terms of being able to monitor patients using wearable devices or having risk screening tools in the background in the electronic medical records to predict who may be at high risk for developing immune toxicities or pneumonitis from newer antibody drug conjugates. Those are going to start making their way into clinical trials as well. And on the industry and CRO side of things, they are increasing their use of AI technologies to perform risk-based monitoring for patients, to be able to look for new trends in toxicities, markers of efficacy, which is going to, I hope, turn on its head how data is collected and what type of data can be submitted to even regulatory agencies for either label expansion or to get their approvals when people try to glean more insights into the data that they've collected for their clinical trials.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, I've actually seen some early stage studies looking at remote monitoring for like applying for different cellular therapies where patients can still be at home and like having a vital sign monitor to look for early evidence of things like cytokine release syndrome and other kinds of neurotoxicities. But obviously, you can have risks and benefits of all those different things. I'm just very briefly just to kind of sort of tie things back to the beginning. We were talking about sort of what industry job looked like and sort of what it's like to be in a like non-patient facing role. Can you just give maybe any advice for any of the physicians who are sort of considering making a transition or maybe any perspective on that?
I think it's really important to know what excites you and what you want to learn and how you want to spend your time. I am seeing specifically with current trainees or in recent graduates that they are not necessarily viewing their clinical careers in the way that, my cohort did or folks before me did. And that's daunting, and it's also very liberating at the same time. One of my mentors talked about having a framework where somebody looks to reinvent themselves every now and then and learns a new skill, something to keep them engaged, something to grow internally with. There's some debate on how often that should happen and what the right frequency for that should be. Most folks will say that that's around the 5 to 7 years, where you see people have plateaued in the work that they're doing and they're looking for the next sort of wave of growth opportunities. So I don't view industry positions or non-clinical positions as something to target. I think it's for the person at the right time if they're looking for another growth opportunity and that's where they want to grow. I think it's important for them to consider. There are also opportunities in nonprofit organizations, tremendously and increasing opportunities in the health tech space that are looking for physicians. And what I'm hoping is with the development of these newer AI-enabled tools that physicians can start developing and at least develop their own minimum viable product for an idea that they have, even if they don't have coding experience and those bits. So I'm hoping that people will start jumping more into that space and we'll see much more innovative and practice-changing tools being developed by clinicians themselves. So I guess the answer to your question in a roundabout way is that it needs to come from inside. I don't think that trying to assign a certain label or external metric is sustainable or is the best way to think about it. And generally, history will say that it's, the 5 to 7 year mark where people are looking to reinvent themselves. And a lot of folks are able to do that within the or institution that they are formerly or they're currently working at, where they assume a different responsibility, develop a different program, a different administrative job, or have opportunities to consult and help other people with their work. So I think even in academic programs, we're seeing more flexibility in the type of work that people are being involved in and work that's being given credit in P&T committees and is being recognized as being meaningful and significant.
Thanks for sharing that. That's all the time we have today for our College Data Advisor episode. Thanks so much, Arturi, again for your time, and look forward to maybe having it in the future.
Thanks for having me.